Hello and welcome to the West City Church podcast. If you'd like to get to know us more, find us at westcitychurch.com.au. We really hope that you're encouraged by today's message.
So I'm going to say something super, super profound today, and that is that I don't know anything. Like, I used to do this thing called beach mission. I used to go down south and used to just like, you know, go and evangelize to a bunch of people. And as I got older, I was like, what on earth are we doing here? Like, what is going on? Like, why on earth is everyone walking around telling everybody that they're a bunch of sinners? And I was like, I don't know how I feel about that. So I got in this debate with somebody on the way back, and I was kind of like, why is it that we just go, like, why is it that everyone's going around telling everybody that they're a sinner? Like, I thought we were also called to be saints. Like, I thought we were also called to be like God's chosen people. Like, this is, why aren't we preaching that first? Like, that's pretty cool. I feel like we might be scaring people away. And anyway, so we had this like hour long conversation about it. And I just got to the point where I was like, oh, I don't know. And you know what? 5 years later on, I still don't know. And I don't really want anyone after the service to come up to me to be like, I have the answer for you. Don't do it. I'm happy not knowing, to be honest. Like, you know what? I've actually preferred to stay in that place of not knowing. But the only thing that I feel like I know about my faith for certain is that table. Like, that table of the Lord is just always consistent. It is always good. It is always right. And it is always for certain. Like, no matter who you are, where you've come from, that is all I really know. And as I find, like, in time that I just get a bit, like, stale with faith or just, like, feeling like I don't want to be sitting in a Sunday service or whatever, I would come every single week just to watch everyone in our congregation line up for communion and take it, because that is the most wholesome thing for me and my faith in the world. And so even throughout the weeks, if I decide that I feel like I'm not going to come, I'm still going to come because I want to take communion with you all, and I want to sit and watch you take communion, and I want to watch you, you know, hug each other and smile and enjoy that moment that you get to have with Jesus, because I want to have it too, and I'm excited that you get to have it. And so I have this beautiful book called The Book of Common Prayer, which obviously I can't hold up very well, because also another thing I don't know about, prayer. Know nothing about it. So instead I just read liturgies and I read prayers that other people have written who are way smarter and way more majestic than I am. And so I'm going to read you. It's like, you know how we have our like call to the table? This is, it's in there, but it's like, it also comes with a response. And so I'm going to read you the response for the call to the table. And it's meant to be like all said together, but that's just way too hard because it's like a, you know, solid paragraph. So I'm just going to read it over us this morning before we go and take communion, wherever, however you're sitting there, whatever you do know, whatever you don't know, we're just going to have it together because we can, and it's majestic and it's mysterious, but it's so wonderful. And so let me just read this over all of us today. Loving God, through your goodness, we have this bread and wine to offer, which has come forth from the earth and human hands have made. May we know your presence in sharing, so that we may know your touch and presence in all things. We celebrate the life that Jesus has shared among his community through the centuries and shares with us now. Made in one Christ and one with each other, we offer these gifts and with them ourselves, a single living act of praise. Amen.
All right, I'm going to get the whiteboard. Whilst I'm doing that, I just want everyone who's on the podcast listening to have the heads up that you miss so much good banter and you miss a lot of good worship. Cool. Rock and roll. How you guys going? Good, good. Guys, I'm chatting today about the silver in our ashes to Hallelujahs. It's right there. That's what I'm doing today. We're going to be talking about the silver, and obviously with the silver, we can't separate what we know of the silver without talking about Judas Iscariot as well. Judas Iscariot, super cool guy, textually. We know a lot about him, but Before we jump into betrayal, I want you guys to just have the heads up. This, like, was not fun to research because you don't get anywhere. Trying to understand betrayal is futile. You can't make sense of it. And I hope, if anything, that maybe we don't make sense of it by the end. Similar to Ash was saying today, it might be one of those things that we actually don't need a very good answer for. But I want you guys to understand it, right? Because you need to understand Friday to understand Sunday. So betrayal is something that each of us would understand to some degree. Maybe you've been betrayed. Maybe you've betrayed. Maybe it's just coming for you and it's lurking at your door. Who knows? Don't trust anyone. But sometimes it could be our partner that betrays us, our friends that betray us. Maybe sometimes you might have a bit of a grumbly tummy and your body might betray you. But there are lots of ways in which we can understand betrayal. Betrayal is essentially saying, hey, hold on, you're not supposed to do that. You're doing the opposite of what I actually wanted you to do. So I'm going to ask a few questions that we actually can't necessarily answer, unless if you can see me at the back afterwards, keen to hear the answer. But I want to ask, without the betrayal, can crucifixion actually happen? Can the crucifixion be fulfilled? Does prophecy require the betrayal, or does it merely fulfil it? And does Jesus need to be betrayed? These were some of the things that I was kind of looking at, and I don't have answers for. So if you come for that today, I'm sorry. You can leave now. in historical... Can we go to the next slide? Amazing. This is a piece by Caravaggio. I've got a friend of mine who's an art historian, and during COVID lockdowns, he pulled apart art history for us, for a bunch of us. And he's not a Christian or anything, but this was a really awesome piece that we looked at. And I know not in this piece, it's not true, but in the artistic representations historically of Judas Iscariot, he's generally got red hair. It's the sign of the devil, and that's very true. So you know, Josh, where is he? Yeah. Watch out, guys. But Judas Iscariot, over time, he's kind of become he kind of saddles a lot of anti-Semitism, I'll say, a lot of people like to put a lot on him without maybe pulling apart his character a little bit more, trying to understand him a bit more. And Judas is one of those characters that gets to escape the literature and comes into the secular society. And we can, you know, you've heard people say, oh, he's a Judas or something. And I want to kind of de-entangle what the world tells us about Judas and actually what the text tells us about Judas. I'm not going to say that they're massively different, but also we do need to take some scales off of it. So what do we know about Judas Iscariot is his name? Iscariot could mean one of two things, and we don't know. Iscariot could be a man from Kariath, which is a village south of Hebron in Judah. Is it? Yes, it is. It's in the region of Judah, which would mean that Judas would be the one disciple who's not from Galilee. The other thing that it could mean is Judas Iscariot could mean that he's from the Sicarios. And the Sicarii were a splinter group of Jewish zealots. They were radicals, they were revolutionaries, and they were fighting to free Judea from the clutch of the Roman occupiers. What they would do is they would dress up in cloaks, and they'd go into public areas, and they would find people who are either Romans or Roman sympathisers, and they would drop a dagger into them, and they would just melt back into the crowd. And this is their way of fighting against their oppressors. So, what we're going to do today is we're going to flip back and forth between a few different texts. I know it looks like we're doing Bible roulette here. We're not. But I kind of need you to understand some little bits and pieces about the betrayal to actually understand the betrayal. Without the Friday, we don't understand Sunday. So, I'm not saying everything's prophecy. I want to say that there are lots of parallels, and we need to understand those parallels, because without those parallels, without hearing where else these things happen, we can't fully understand the cross. So I just want to set the scene for you. We're going to talk about the kiss, silver coins, blood fields, death of Judas. Who bears the blame for Jesus and death ultimately, and Christ's crucifixion, what happens next? So the whole selling for Jesus for 30 bits of silver thing never really quite quenched my thirst to understand why, but it's the best explanation that I had that I had ever heard as to why Judas would betray Jesus, was that he wanted revolution, and he believed that he saw if the people saw Jesus being taken away, they would rise up and they would fight off their oppressors, because Passover is a time in which the most Roman soldiers are in Jerusalem. It is ripe. It is a time of revolution because everyone is thinking, we were led out of Egypt and now it's time for you to take these Romans away. The air is electric, right? Jesus has just sat down. He's got the Pharisees and the Sadducees, who are two political kind of groups, the Sadducees being the aristocratic families, the Pharisees being legal observers who believe in the resurrection, and who normally hate each other, but they come together to go, oh, let's go get this guy Christ. So Jesus arranged for the 12 apostles to come over and have a little dinner party, and he tells one of them that one of them is going to betray them, and they're all like, oh, no, Jesus, it's not me, I don't think so. And in Matthew, Mark and Luke, the one who betrays Jesus is the one who dips his hand into the dish with Jesus, and in John, what Jesus does is he actually dips the bread into a dish, and then he says, whoever takes this bread is the one who betrays me, and he just gives it to Judah, you know, doesn't out him or anything. And next thing, you know, we're in the Garden of Gethsemane, and we have our first stop on our betrayal excursion. So we have the kiss, and we know that Jesus is betrayed with a kiss, but this isn't the first time that we actually have a kiss of betrayal. In 2 Samuel 20, verse 9, you have the story of Sheba rebelling against David, and you have these two characters. You have Joab and Amasa, and what happens in this verse is Joab walks up to Amasa, and with his right hand, he moves his beard to the side, and he goes to give him a kiss, and just before he kisses him, he stabs him, and he dies. This is the first time we hear about a kiss being used as betrayal, and it's not the last as well. Jesus had long spoken about the betrayal that would come, but now it's here. You can understand that it's this heartbreaking thing that he would still have to go through. One of the interesting things that I actually couldn't move past when reading in the different accounts of the betrayal is that in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus is in this panic, stressed place where I think you can remember he talks about sweating blood clots because he can't cope with this betrayal that's about to come. He's talked about it the whole time. It gets introduced really early in John when he's like halfway through his ministry. He's hanging out after they've all fed the 5,000. He says, oh, but one of you is going to betray me. And they're like, what? But one of the things that kind of irritated me about this text is that they spend so long in the garden. The disciples, they fall asleep and wake up three times. Jesus is there just waiting for it to happen. And you just want to yell at the story and say, Jesus, run. We know how the story ends, and this is one of the issues that I kind of sat with, being like, I can't answer. Why was it that this had to be fulfilled? Why did Jesus have to be betrayed? Why is this an essential part of the text? Because they know who he is. He could walk down the main street and be arrested. I didn't understand this, and I still have issues with it. Anyway, another important parallel that we need to draw is the coins. So in Matthew, Judas is paid 30 silver coins for his betrayal of Jesus. Importantly, he's paid this money in advance of doing the deed. In Genesis, we have the story of Judah selling his brother Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. Now, in the text, Genesis in 37:28, Leviticus 27:5, Exodus 21:32, we get given a model for the exchange of a life. A slave's life is, a man's life is 20 pieces of silver, a woman's is 10. There is an economy around selling people. There is a set price on a life, and I need you to remember that because we're going to come right back to that one. And then we have the death of Judas. One death which is lesser known, and it's a pretty heavy metal death, is the death that we have in Acts, where Judas, he takes his silver and he buys a field from a potter. A potter's field just means very clay kind of thing. And then he's walking one day and he falls over and then his body just bursts and his intestines spill out, which is pretty heavy metal. The one that we more commonly know is the death in Matthew, where Judas, upon hearing of Jesus being condemned to die, he's filled with remorse. He takes the 30 pieces of silver back to the high priest and elders and he says, I've sinned. I've betrayed an innocent man and now have innocent blood on my hands. See if we care, they replied. Deal with it yourself. And he throws the money down in the temple and he leaves and he goes and hangs himself. Well now, said the chief priest, pick up the money. According to the law, the money can't be put in the temple treasury. It's the price of someone's blood. What's the price of someone's blood? Great, 20 pieces of silver, that's it. But it's 30, anyway. So they had a discussion and they used it to buy the potter's field as a burial place for foreigners. And that's why the place is called the Field of Blood to this day. Then the words spoken by Jeremiah, the prophet, came true. They took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of the one who was valued by the children of Israel, and they gave them the potter's field as the Lord instructed me. And that's Zechariah 11. That's the one piece of prophecy that's fulfilled. And in both versions of Judas's death, we have a potter's field being bought with the money for the price of someone's life. That's a fulfillment of prophecy. We can't walk past that one. A few things happen in this passage. One, prophecy is fulfilled in Zechariah. Two, we have in both of the versions the potter's field, we've said that. But in Matthew, importantly, Judas hangs himself. But before he does that, he gives the 30 pieces of silver back to those so that he is paid to betray Jesus. I've sinned, I've killed an innocent man, I have innocent blood on my hands. Which again is a parallel that we have with King David and Ahithophel? Anyway, it's got a funny name, Ahithophel, which is actually David's counsellor. And he betrays him. He betrays David, has innocent blood, and hangs himself again. The aspect of the hanging here is significant. Judas's remorse is significant. The Pharisees tell Judas to go sort it out yourself, and Judas does so by hanging himself. This is because with both Ahithophel and Judas, the price of death of an innocent is death. This is clear in Deuteronomy, this is clear in Numbers, we get it from Leviticus as well. The price that must be paid for death of an innocent life is death, or innocent blood, as they keep referring to it. You have heard it said, an eye for an eye. But Judas carries out his punishment on himself, and he has given back the silver because he no longer wishes to be responsible for Jesus' death. He wishes to absolve himself from what will take place. Now Jesus is in the hands of his captors, and he's given over to Pilate. Pilate's wife has a dream about Jesus. She's all messed up about it. She sends a message to Pilate, says, I need you to have nothing to do with this man. There's been a bad omen. Don't get involved. And as we know, you know, come the day, it's customary for them to release a prisoner from during Passover, and the crowd is shouting for Jesus Barabbas. And though Pilate is trying to reason with the crowd and asks them, but what is the crime of this Jesus of Nazareth? The crowd only shouts louder, and they're shouting for Barabbas, and a riot begins to brew. And here we see the second time someone tries to cleanse themselves of responsibility for what will happen to Christ. In Matthew 27:24, Pilate saw it was no good. In fact, there was a riot brewing, so he took some water and he washed his hands in front of the crowd. I'm not guilty of this man's blood, he said. It's your problem. And the people responded, let his blood be on us and on our children. So now we have a situation in which the responsibility for Jesus' blood has moved from Judas to his captors, to Pilate, and then onto the people. Let his blood be on us and on the hands of our children. Now, we know what happens next. I don't want to get ahead of Easter. I want to sit with the betrayal for a second. We need to understand Friday to understand Sunday. So you may know this place, being the betrayer or the person who's been betrayed. I've known both sides, honestly, and they're both awful. Once you've done it or it's happened to you, your world can be turned upside down. And you give just about anything to go back or to not know that it happened. And it hurts, and I've seen it even this week with some friends that I love very, very much. It's a messy place, and these are messy texts, and not everything does line up, but there are important things that keep us on a parallel here, right? The truth is we can't make sense of the betrayal, and we can't understand what was on the heart or the mind of Judas during the betrayal. Understanding the betrayal is futile. I can't make these texts give any warmth or light into the betrayals that have happened in your own lives, and I hope, if anything, I've been able to explain exactly nothing about the nature of betrayal. And I don't want to dive into what happens next, but I need you to leave with what we learn from Jesus and Judas. If you are the betrayer, have remorse. Seek to repay what you have taken and put yourself at the mercy of the person that you have betrayed. And if you don't do that, go buy a potter's field, fall over and explode, okay? The texts are very clear, no. But if you, but and if you've been betrayed, unfortunately, it is a bear hunt, right? And whether it's grassy, like messy grass, or it's a cave, or it's a river, you can't go over it, you can't go under it, you can't go around it, you have to go through it. All we can learn from Jesus, if Jesus were our signposts on what happens next after the in the afterlife shattering, excuse me guys, if Jesus is our signpost for what happens next when your life has been shattered by betrayal, let it be this. He looks out onto the people that are at his execution and he says, "Forgive them, for they know not what they do. Forgive them," right? We have a man that there is no ethical way to sin. You can't absolve yourself of sin if you choose so, but you can understand the transfer of how they're trying to change who actually carries Jesus' sin from Judas to his captors to Pilate and then eventually to the people who say, "Yes, his blood is on us." And Jesus absolves them and says, "Forgive them." He looks down to the people at his execution, the people that called for his execution and yelled to Pontius Pilate that they take responsibility for the blood that says it is that, and says this, "Forgive them, for they know not what they do." Even the most high treasonous act of deicide are people who kill our God, the greatest height of betrayal, and we're shown what it is to respond with the deepest of love. I've screamed for Barabbas. I've yelled, "Let his blood be on us." I've mocked an innocent blood as they've marched up their own personal Calvary. And still, in the greatest height of betrayal, we're shown what it is to love in the deepest way. And here's what God does next in the text. He overcomes betrayal, crucified, dies, goes through death, and is resurrected. We know the story of betrayal, and we know the cost is not 30 pieces of silver, but it's far greater. We know that the toil of that place, and you might actually be going through that betrayal right now, and you might know that betrayal and your own betrayal and or your deep and hidden remorse for your own act of betrayal. You may know these places. They may be very familiar to you. Keep going. You can't go under it, around it, over it. You've got to go through it, right? If you're going through it, you need to understand that the way that you get through it is through forgiveness, right? But you need to know that even if you're not in that place just yet, on the other side, there is resurrection. There is life. It is abundant. There is ascension. If the band and communion service want to come up, just make your way out, guys. Look, we know the stories are messy and they don't always add up. And if you feel like today, you can relate a little bit more to the story of Judas than anyone else, I've got good news for you guys. There's a version of what happens with Judas as well in John, one where he doesn't die a gruesome death. So he's there after the resurrection, counted among the 12 disciples. No gruesome death. So whether you were Judas in the story or you were the betrayed, there is a possibility of forgiveness and a version of restoration and perhaps reconciliation if you so choose. The greatest height is met with the deepest of love. And I want to close with an extract from a poem called The Transfiguration by Edwin Muir. "Then he would come, Christ the uncrucified, Christ the discrucified, his death undone, his agony unmade, his cross dismantled, glad to be so, and the tormented wood will cure its heart and grow into a tree in a green springing corner of young Eden, and Judas damned take his long journey backward from darkness into life and be a child beside his mother's knee, and the betrayal be quiet, undone, and never done again."
How good was that message? Thank you so much for joining us. Each week at West City, we say a benediction together. We do this because we believe that the purpose of the church is to be a caring community for the world, and that as we go and serve others, we enter into Christ's work of welcome, restoration and healing, both for us and others. We believe that in doing so, we get to see and encounter Christ. So let's say the benediction together. We come together as the church to be reminded of the go of Christ. So we will go out and feed the hungry, go out and clothe the naked, go out and fight for justice, go out and end oppression, go out and proclaim anew the old, old story, go out and associate with those who don't look like us, think like us, act like us and don't even like us. And we'll do it all in the name of the one who sent us. His name is Jesus.